Welcome to Audio Notes. I'm David Finkel, Artistic Director of Music at Menlo. And along with Artistic Co-Director Wu Han, Artistic Administrator Patrick Castillo, and some of this season's festival artists, it is my pleasure to introduce you to the music we'll be hearing as part of Music at Menlo's 2011 season, Through Brahms. This season, Music at Menlo illuminates the historical magnitude of the music of Johannes Brahms. Brahms represents the zenith of the Viennese classical tradition, a tradition cultivated throughout the 18th and 19th centuries by a hallowed lineage of composers, beginning with Haydn, Mozart, and Beethoven. Brahms's earliest works immediately drew comparisons with the greatest of his predecessors. Upon his arrival in Vienna, the musical community quickly proclaimed him the heir of Beethoven. Brahms built on the model of his forebears to create a distinct and powerful voice. He embraced centuries of tradition as a pathway to new and genuine artistic expression. Along the way, he created some of history's greatest chamber music. And in forging such a towering body of work, which no musician has since been able to ignore, Brahms has continued to inspire the most forward-looking composers of the 20th and 21st centuries. This summer features a series of six main concert programs highlighting different facets of Brahms's artistry. These are complemented by a two-concert presentation of the Brahms string quartets, the festival's Carte Blanche concert series of artist-curated recitals, and our Signature Encounters series, which, along with audio notes, provide thorough context to the festival's many concert offerings. We're glad to have you with us for what promises to be another exciting season at Music at Menlo. Thanks for listening, and we look forward to seeing you at the concerts.
Just as he integrated the music of his predecessors, so did Brahms point the way forward for many of the 20th century's greatest composers. This summer's second concert program, Brahms the Prismatic, looks at Brahms on the one hand as the culminating point of centuries of compositional craft, and on the other as a catalyst for divergent musical directions in the 20th century, as he distilled the influence of his forebears for future generations. While he insatiably absorbed the canon from Haydn, Mozart, and Beethoven to the early Romantics, Brahms revered Johann Sebastian Bach above all. Brahms obsessively pored over Bach's manuscripts, through the study of which he mastered the art of counterpoint and fugue. Bach's influence can be heard throughout Brahms's oeuvre. In Brahms's E minor cello sonata, for instance, the fugal subject of the final movement, directly quotes one of the fugues from Die Kunst der Fuge, The Art of Fugue, Bach's valedictory cycle of fugues and canons, composed at the end of the Baroque master's life.
Brahms was surely also familiar with Bach's set of six suites for solo cello when composing his own cello sonatas. The suites were composed around 1720, during Bach's tenure as Kapellmeister, or music director, at the court of Köthen, a German principality where he served from 1717 to 1723. Much of Bach's greatest secular and instrumental music dates from this period, including the sonatas and partitas for solo violin and the Brandenburg concertos. The cello suites ran alongside these as some of Bach's most iconic works and have become an essential part of the cello repertoire. Concert Program 2 begins with Bach's second cello suite in D minor.
With the exception of a couple of pieces that are marginally pieces for cello as a solo instrument written before Bach, really, there is nothing.
Cellist Lawrence Lesser.
nothing for the instrument to be treated as a solo instrument. And the fact that the six suites were written probably during his period of time when he was working in Curtin for the prince who didn't much care for religious music, it's just astonishing that these pieces all of a sudden were written. Maybe it is the presence of a pretty good cello player at the court in Curtin that stimulated Bach to write something for cello. If you look at the so-called obituary written by Carl Philipp Emanuel Bach, written, I think, two or three years after his father died, one of the things that he mentions, it goes to trouble to mention, are the cello suites. And so it is quite clear that, at least from C.P.E. Bach's considerations, that his father thought, realized somehow or other that he'd done something quite special. The D minor suite has a certain severe quality to it. It's almost like what I think about in some of the Spanish Baroque music, or even if you go later to flamenco or something like that, where there is this pride and this backbone to it.
To hear more from my conversation with Lawrence Lesser about the Bach cello suites, please visit us online at www.musicatmenlo.org/multimedia/audio notes. Just as Brahms looked back to the music of Bach, composers in the 20th and 21st centuries have continued to echo essential qualities of Brahms's music. Whether the romantic lyricism of his most rapturous slow movements or the impeccable craftsmanship of his most finely wrought scores. This summer's Brahms the Prismatic program juxtaposes two 20th century composers who pursued completely different musical languages, but whose respective debts to Brahms's influence are equally clear. The Russian pianist and composer Sergei Rachmaninoff was one of the last great champions of the Romantic aesthetic. He lived from 1873 to 1943, contemporaneously with the early 20th century's most transformative voices, Claude Debussy, Igor Stravinsky, Arnold Schoenberg, and others. But while these composers challenged the boundaries of tradition with such defiant scores as The Rite of Spring and Pierrot Lunaire, Rachmaninoff adhered to the romantic principles of melodic lyricism and unabashedly personal expressivity. Rachmaninoff's Vocalise demonstrates these qualities in spades. It is the last of a set of 14 songs composed in 1912 for the soprano Antonina Nezhdanova. Rachmaninoff was so enamored of Nezhdanova's voice, he decided to compose a song for her without text, so that the natural beauty of her voice would be the sole focus of the music. The Vocalises Take No Prisoners' melodic beauty has inspired a myriad of arrangements for other instruments, ranging from solo strings to theremin and electric guitar. Concert Program 2 features the Vocalise in one of its more conventional and most widely cherished transcriptions for violin and piano. Violinist Ian Swenson.
It's such an incredible love song. I think sad. I think really sad and soaring. The pitches move slowly and they descend stepwise. And then it sort of reaches up. And then it goes back to this main melody over and over and over again. And the interludes sort of try to rise it up to another level. Just, I think, a gorgeous love song. I mean, to me, it's just amazingly beautifully suspended. It seems suspended and classical in a way where there's so much beautiful counterpoint happening, but romantic in a way where the sound and the feeling and the colors seem to be liquid, just in a deep sort of liquid state of breath, you know? unusually fluid music.
Near the end of the 19th century, while Brahms continued to work within traditional classical forms, legions of young composers gathered at the altar of Richard Wagner and Franz Liszt, the figures widely heralded as revolutionaries, pointing the way towards the future of music and art. But despite his adherence to the past, Brahms's music looked forward in its own right as well. No less a modernist iconoclast than Arnold Schoenberg counted Brahms among his greatest influences. Schoenberg, the inventor of the 12-tone method of composition that turned 20th century music on its ear, recognized techniques in Brahms's music that shaped his own innovations, which he described in a famous 1947 essay entitled Brahms the Progressive. To highlight the diversity of Brahms's legacy in the 20th century, Concert Program 2 offers the curious pairing of Rachmaninoff's Vocalise and Arnold Schoenberg's Fantasy for violin and piano, Opus 47.
The Opus 47 Fantasy, composed in 1949, is Schoenberg's final instrumental work. Interestingly, Schoenberg composed it first as a work for solo violin. Only when the violin part was complete, from beginning to end, did he set to work on the piano accompaniment. The 12-tone method is a system by which, instead of following the traditional rules of harmony and counterpoint, a piece is organized by a systemic ordering of pitches. The work's rigorous construction according to the 12-tone method allowed for this unconventional compositional process to work. While Schoenberg's technique represents a bold departure from Brahms's musical language, the insistence that every note be absolutely essential to the overall structure of the piece is something that the two composers share. In the words of one commentator, the Fantasy, quote, represents the height of the composer's 12-tone complexity and the complete subordination of oral concerns to those of rigorous order and derivation. End quote.
Ian Swenson.
The Schoenberg is highly expressive, and in a way, extremely romantic, but in another way, extremely abstract. It uncovers itself slowly, and it makes more and more sense. And yet there are moments where I'm listening and I'm studying and I just go, what is this? It's so far out. He uses a lot of strange techniques using harmonics that don't speak easily, played along with solid notes, with tremolos. He does very odd things that create a very modern texture, but within a very expressive field. The middle section is more lyric, and then there's a recapitulation. He also writes sort of scherzos or sort of crazy waltzes in the middle of the piece. ¶¶ The basic phrase shapes are very classical. The way that pitch is used, the way that pitch is used expressively, is farther out than the chromaticism and the dissonances and the reaching of Brahms. But the actual forms are quite classical. It's also written with a recapitulation and a coda, and it's written in a form that you could actually recognize even on a first listening.
Last summer at Music at Menlo, we heard an earlier work of Schoenberg's, the Opus 9 Chamber Symphony. For more on Schoenberg and the 12-tone method, visit us online at musicatmenlo.org/multimedia/audionotes, where you can download an excerpt from last season's audio notes. While the lyricism of Rachmaninoff's vocalese recalls Brahms the Romanticist, and Schoenberg's Opus 47 Fantasy is indebted to Brahms the Progressive, the music of American composer John Harbison further reflects each of these dimensions. Born in New Jersey in 1938, John Harbison is, in his compositional aesthetic, something of a modern-day Brahms. He has steadily resisted the avant-garde trends of his generation, choosing instead to express himself through traditional classical forms. In doing so, he has assembled one of the most compelling bodies of work among the composers of our time. This summer's Brahms the Prismatic program prefaces Brahms with music written nearly a century after his death, John Harbison's Piano Quintet, composed in 1981. Besides being inescapably haunted by the specter of Brahms' own piano quintet, a version of which closes the program, the Harbison Quintet is likewise a powerful musical statement in its own right.
It's a really expressive piece, and it's a really direct piece.
Ian Swenson.
But also sort of intellectual and elusive in a way. So it's something that feels visceral and connective. To me, it's something between Schoenberg and Rachmaninoff, but in a modern style, in a intense but cool style.
The quintet is dedicated to the American artist Georgia O'Keeffe. Harbison provides the following program note. Certain aims have governed my recent work, never more than in this piece. To give the medium what it requires, to strike a balance between the hermetic and the easily reachable, and make clear form of inherently complex emotion. In looking at the work of Georgia O'Keeffe, it struck me that the point of contact was this characteristically American search for clarity out of complex forces. In opening my piece, I thought of the unfilled parts of her canvases, the open space, and the pleasure of leaving something out.
It starts out with a violin duet, as I remember, just in two parts, and then that develops, and then it breaks right away into a fugue that's very rhythmic.
Harbison's note continues, "The opening strain dominates the first movement of the quintet in spite of the energy of the contrasting material. The amplitude of the discourse is contradicted by the three concise character pieces which follow." The second movement of Harbison's quintet is a wry capriccio. At the center of the quintet is a contemplative intermezzo. Harbison curiously labels the fourth movement a burletta, a term used to describe a genre of English comic opera around the turn of the 19th century. It's a pithy movement, lasting just about 2 minutes, but marked by great dramatic intensity.
He intersperses very minimal, linear, lyric, expressive music with stuff that's much more Bartokian or energetic, rhythmic, percussive. He'll go into sort of zones where there are a lot of repeated notes, a lot of cadenzas that seem very spectral, that seem very like twilight. And then he'll sort of come back from it. But I find it a very evocative piece and really eye-catching, really alive.
The quintet ends with an impassioned elegy. Harbison writes that this final movement, quote, reflects in its open-ended form the unresolved questions it poses at every turn, end quote. Following the death of Robert Schumann in 1856, Brahms emerged as chamber music's most important voice. The early 1860s marked a coming of age for Brahms, often referred to as his first maturity, in which a newfound artistic sophistication came to the fore, as exhibited by various chamber works. These included such masterpieces as the two-string sextets, opuses 18 and 36, the piano quartets, opuses 25 and 26, the Opus 40 Horn Trio, and arguably the most widely beloved of Brahms's chamber works, the Opus 34 Piano Quintet. The piano quintet underwent a curious genesis. The work began as a string quintet for two violins, viola, and two cellos. Completed in 1862, the quintet in this original version was deemed imperfect by both the composer and his trusted confidant, Joseph Joachim. Brahms rearranged the piece into a sonata for two pianos, which he premiered with the pianist Karl Tausig in 1864. This version for two pianos would ultimately serve as a blueprint for the final incarnation of the Opus 34 Piano Quintet. The version as a sonata for two pianos exhibits the composer's methodical perfectionism in crystalline form, achieving between two keyboards the quintet's symphonic breadth. Pianist Alessio Bax.
Then what also be playing in the festival, the two piano version of his piano quintet. And that's really masterful writing for two pianos. I mean, I hear textures that are difficult to hear in the piano quintet, which I've played much more often, of course. But it's really, it feels like it's a piece that was meant to be that way as well. I think the two piano version would be very interesting because it's like looking at a familiar site from a different angle. There are so many things that you hear more clearly. And of course, you know, we all have in the ears, Lucille and I will have the quintet version in mind. So we're also trying to recreate different sounds from the strings, but the textures are incredibly clear.
Brahms's music for two pianists, including this sonata for two pianos, and a number of works for two pianists at one keyboard, such as the Liebeslieder waltzes that appear in Concert Program 4, and the Opus 39 waltzes that Alessio Bax and Lucille Chung will perform as part of Alessio's Carte Blanche program this summer. This music is remarkable for the balance it strikes between intimacy and grandeur. The medium is inherently intimate. Two players, each with exactly the same color palette at his or her disposal. But a work like the Sonata for Two Pianos also foreshadows the sonic immensity that Brahms ultimately fulfills in the piano quintet.
It really feels more symphonic as well, because you don't have that balance in the two ends of the piano and the strings. There is not an element of that kind. So there are really two forces working at the same time.
Music at Menlo presented the Brahms Piano Quintet in 2005. For more on the quintet, you can visit us online at musicatmenlo.org/multimedia/audio notes to download an excerpt from that season's audio notes series. Audio Notes are authored and produced by Patrick Castillo and narrated by David Finkel, Patrick Castillo, and Wu Han. Additional mastering is provided by Dahong Situ. Musical excerpts on this disc appear courtesy of the following performers and organizations: Johannes Brahms's Opus 8 Piano Trio, performed by the Florestan Trio, and Opus 18 Sextet, performed by the Raphael Ensemble, Franz Schubert's Notturno, performed by the Florestan Trio, and Johann Sebastian Bach's Cello Suite No. 2, performed by Stephen Isserlis, appear courtesy of Hyperion Records. Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart's Violin Sonata in E minor, K304, performed by Itzhak Perlman and Daniel Barenboim, Johann Sebastian Bach's The Art of Fugue, performed by the Emerson String Quartet, and Arnold Schoenberg's Opus 47 Fantasy, performed by Gidon Kramer, appear with kind permission of Deutsche Grammophon GmbH Hamburg, www.deutschegrammophon.com. Brahms's Scherzo in C minor, performed by Itzhak Perlman and Vladimir Ashkenazi, and Sergei Rachmaninoff's Vocalise, performed by Itzhak Perlman and Samuel Sanders, appear courtesy of EMI Classics. Brahms's Sonata for Two Pianos, Opus 34b, is performed by Paulina Zamora and John Milbauer, and appears courtesy of Eroica Records. Robert Schumann's Fairy Tales, performed by David Schifrin, Paul Neubauer, and Gilles von Sattel, and John Harbison's Piano Quintet, performed by Gilbert Kalisch and the Orion String Quartet, appear courtesy of the Chamber Music Society of Lincoln Center. Bach's Brandenburg Concerto No. 5, performed by Carol Winsentz, Philip Setzer, Kenneth Cooper, Barry Schiffman, Jeff Nuttall, Leslie Robertson, David Finkel, and Charles Chandler, and Brahms's Opus 34 Piano Quintet, performed by Wuhan, Georgia Flizanis, Ian Swenson, Cynthia Phelps, and Ralf Kirschbaum, appear courtesy of Music at Menlo Live. Audio Notes is a copyrighted production of Artist Led.